Welcome to the Sustainable Ag Writer Podcast, a podcast bringing you news and views about sustainable agriculture from across the southeastern United States. Every show will feature insightful interviews and deep dives into sustainable agriculture topics with farmers, ranchers, land-grant universities, and local food system advocates. Now, here's your host, Brennan Washington.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Sustainable Ag Writer Podcast. I'm your host, Brennan Washington, and I'm glad you could join me today. Today's episode is going to be about raising small ruminants for fiber, so hair sheep, that type of stuff, with the primary goal being not to use the animals for meat production, but to use their hair and hides to develop fibers that could be turned into clothing and that type of stuff. And I want to do a show, a production practice, because the way I've timed this show, a lot of the initial episodes were timed to come out around the many conferences we have here across the South, well, across the country this time of year, dealing with farmers and ranchers. But I want to start making sure I introduce some issues that deal with production practices. So we'll be talking with Keisha Cameron of High Hawk Farm and just discussing small ruminants and just some of the work that she's doing around raising sheep fiber production. So the sun's finally out here in Georgia. We've been having a lot of rainy days, so it's really nice to see the sun. And crazy, I'm going to start getting back on my regular travel schedule. When I'm home, I always hope I have good weather so I can get stuff done around the farm. And it's sort of been kind of frustrating because I haven't been able to do that. So we are working on an area of our farm that we're going to put into some new vegetable production, but we're doing something a little different. So this weekend, we started framing out hoop house. I think it's 16 by 30 or something that we're going to be putting over that production area. But we're going to do something a little different with that space. What we're going to do, we are on a mission, my wife and I, to source as much of our meat from either animals that we grow ourselves, which in this case would be chickens, or from farmers who raise stuff like cattle, goats, and the like. So what we're going to do with this area is this spring, probably in about a month, we're going to order some meat birds, put them on the grass in that area, raise them out. I threw a bunch of clover and wheat seed out there. So they'll have a really good foundation of stuff to eat, good grasses to eat. So we'll run them. They generally typically take us about 6 to 8 weeks to reach harvesting size. We'll go ahead and process them, put them in the freezer. Then follow it up with some vegetables, probably tomatoes or any other vegetable which doesn't really need to touch the ground. So probably won't do lettuce or anything like that, just because we've put chickens in before we'll plant those crops. So that's the idea. We'll do that. We'll raise another batch in the fall and then follow it by a cover crop. So that's going to be our little experiment for us. So we spent, my son and I spent the weekend just getting that framed out, and I got to use a new toy. Every other structure that we've put on a property, be it a greenhouse or a high tunnel, we pretty much pounded the post in with either a post driver, a manual post driver, and initially when we first started with a hammer, believe it or not, I got a gasoline-powered auger. And let me tell you guys, I don't know why I waited so long. It's great. We drilled the holes for one side of the hoop house that we're putting up in about 10 minutes. I think I jacked my shoulder up. This area where we're planting in, one area for some reason is extremely, extremely wet. And so it was real muddy, not like the other post that was in there. It sort of got stuck and it swung me around. I think it jacked up my shoulder a little bit. So I'm really looking forward to doing this and putting those animals out in pasture. Now, post some pictures and stuff when we get done. As we head into Black History Month, one of the things I wanted to point out on today's show is that as we celebrate those leaders of the civil rights movement who worked to give people like myself freedoms that, in many cases, none of them had, that we don't forget about the farmers and landowners who put their land up as collateral when a lot of the civil rights protesters were jailed for protesting, to provide myself with fair and equitable treatment to provide many of you out there listening to that with for fair and equitable treatment. That struggle was helped quite a bit by Southern farmers and ranchers and landowners. And we need to make sure that we, as we celebrate folks during Civil Rights Month, Black History Month, that remember the work that these folks did at potentially great cost to themselves to make sure that we all had a brighter future. So I just wanted to say that. So we're going to be talking about sheep today. And like I said, I wanted to do a show on production. And we are going to be doing a lot of issues that cover all area productions. I'm going to have somebody on to talk about ginger and turmeric production. I met someone recently who's heading up a small grain initiative in Virginia, but I think it's a national effort. So we are going to be talking about those things. And I want to talk with Keisha today about the work she's doing around raising sheep for fiber. Hemp is the big craze now. You can't go to a conference where all anybody wants to hear about really is hemp. I know there's a lot of interest. You know, I think there's a lot of hype out there right now. And the one thing that's interesting is when you hear people talk about hemp, it's always CBD, 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 CBD. Very little talk focuses on some of the other potential uses for hemp, such as fiber. And to me, that's an easier route to go than for farmers who are interested in transitioning to hemp, who may have used production practices that is actually harmful to growing a good crop of hemp, such as use of pesticides, the use of herbicides, a lot of stuff that you would find in traditional row cropping. And hemp sucks all that stuff up out of the soil. And so I've read a couple of stories where people grew acres of hemp, went to take it to a CBD processor, and processors will not take it because of the heavy metals, the pesticide residues, the herbicide residues that hemp has pulled out the soil. So we need to have these conversations about other uses for things on our farms and other potential markets. So remember, when we talk about sustainability, we talk about the three-legged stool, social, financial, and environmental. And financial viability is extremely important if we're going to keep our small farms going. So we need to be looking at practices that can increase a farmer's income, even if it only adds 10% to the bottom line. It's a diversification, and that farmer's at much less risk of having problems if he's growing or she is growing a diversified portfolio of products. And I think fiber needs to be in that conversation. So we're going to be talking about fiber production with Keisha. Sheep and goats are what are known as ruminants. I've always heard that term, small ruminants, sheep are. But cattle, sheep, goats, buffalo, deer, elk, giraffes, and camels are all ruminants, meaning that their stomachs have four compartments and a very highly specialized way of digesting stuff that maybe other animals can't process, such as chickens and pigs. In this country, most of the research work being done around small ruminants, a great deal of it, if not the most, has been done by our 1890 land-grant universities. So for those of you who don't know about 1890 universities, or why they're called 1890 universities, there was an act in 1862 called the Morrill Act. And that act basically created our land grant systems, and it mainly created the larger land grants. So the University of Georgia is 1862. Virginia Tech is an 1862 university. Clemson is an 1862 university. So these universities were created primarily to help provide education and support to farmers and ranchers in rural areas. So that's where the whole extension system came out of. Those universities do a lot of good work. 1890, the light bulb went on and somebody said, wait a minute, we forgot about the Black population and making sure that those folks are included in these efforts. So in most regions of the country, the fix was just to, all right, we're just going to admit and expand our services to cover Black and brown people. However, with the South being the South, it was like, no, we're not going to do that. We're just going to set up a separate system of universities. And so that's how the 1890s came to be created. Your 1890s are schools like Tuskegee, Virginia State, Fort Valley State University here in Georgia, FAMU down in Florida. These are all of our 1890 universities, and they have spearheaded the bulk of research on small ruminants in the United States. Every 2 years, they get together and put on a conference called the National Goat Conference, which covers everything small ruminant related. They've done a lot of research on preventing parasites and parasite control in small ruminants, which goats and to a certain extent sheep can suffer from because of our climatic conditions here in the South. We have a tendency to generate or harbor parasites that are that can be harmful to goats and sheep. So the 1890s have done a lot of research around that. And the overwhelming majority of folks who raise small ruminants do so for meat production. So fiber is not really thought of when people think of small ruminants. They're growing it for meat. And a demand for small ruminants, although goat and sheep are not pale in comparison in American diets when you compare it to beef, pork, and chicken, there is starting to be growing demand for these animals as a food item. You know, just the growth of immigrant populations brings with it demands for stuff like goat and sheep and that type of stuff. So it's really been fascinating to watch how this area of production has grown. When we talk about goats and sheep, we're talking about animals who are master escape artists. So fencing is always an issue. In addition to the problems that you have with parasites and stuff like that, you know, you need to have really, really good fences. You need to have proper mix food that they like to eat. Most small sheep are grazers, so they eat grasses the same way cattle and stuff do. But goats are browsers, so they'll eat woody shrubs and that type of stuff. You wouldn't plant any fruit trees anywhere where you have goats because they'll be gone the next day. They just like that type of food. And I love goat meat. Glad to see that the market for this stuff is growing. As we're going to talk about in later shows, one of the big problems with increased adoption of foods like goat and sheep, and even to a certain extent, locally grown beef, pork, and chicken, one of the major obstacle in making these animals, A, more widely available, and B, more widely available at a affordable cost, has been the lack of processing infrastructure. So let's say, you know, I mentioned that I'm going to be growing out some chickens, which we're going to harvest for ourselves. Let's say I want to sell those. I literally would have to take my chickens out of state to a processing plant, either South Carolina or Tennessee, in order to get them processed. Georgia does not have a single state certified or federally certified processing plant. So those people who do, and I do know some farmers who go ahead and do raise, say, let's say chickens, go ahead and raise chickens for market, once again, trying to make sure that they have diversified streams of income. They have to put those chickens in a trailer, drive them out of state, and one or two things will happen. Either they'll come back home and get a call when the chickens are done, or they'll stay there. So you're talking about the cost of gas. You're talking about the cost of a hotel room if you need to stay, and then the trip back. And that significantly cuts into your bottom line. So most farmers who do this grow a large number. The number I've always heard in order to even think about paying for itself is 20,000. So you have to do at least 20,000 birds a year to make that financially feasible. And that's why when you go to farmers markets, you'll see chickens $6 or $7 a pound. I'm sure that if farmers could get their processing done closer to home at affordable rates, those prices will certainly come down. That hasn't been the case. Unlike chickens, which you find in the grocery stores, which are part of a fully enclosed supply chain that is owned by a company like Purdue, they own everything from the chick all the way up to when that chicken reaches your grocery shelves. And so that's why I think that we need to get some more processing infrastructure into place to help these farmers who obviously had a market. I know a farmer in West Georgia who basically had to stop selling goat because demand was so great. He wasn't keeping enough animals in order to build his herd. That's how great the demand was. And so there's definitely a market down there. I met with the Mississippi Meat Goat Producers Cooperative about 2 years ago. And that was the major complaint. They could sell all the product, they could grow, but they got no way to take it to be processed. One of the things I hope some of these producers look at is looking at the areas of fiber. And it's nice to see a lot of this stuff coming together. So there's a young lady up in Tennessee who has been researching and bringing back the production of indigo, which is a plant that produces dyes. So most blue jeans today have synthetic dyes or dyed with a synthetic process. But a long time ago, that used to be all natural dyes. So she's bringing, and she's doing a couple interesting things. She's doing some variety trials, see what works best in her region. But the other thing she's doing, she's working with former tobacco farmers. What she did was develop a model, an economic model, where those farmers were sign on to grow the indigo, knowing that they'll get X amount of dollars per acre when they start out. So unlike many commodity farmers, of which tobacco used to be, you're not as subject to the whims of the market as you are with things like cotton, tobacco, and that type of stuff. But it's interesting because one of the things you'll hear Keisha talk about is experimenting with sheep that have different color wools, and then how she plans to at some point look at some of these natural dyes to do value-added products, be it clothing, or paint, that type of stuff, to use natural dyes and develop a line of value-added products to sell off her farm. Once again, diversifying that stream of income. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. I think you'll find the show very interesting. I'll have links to information such as the Indigo Project, as well as the information that Keisha has provided me in the show notes. And I hope you enjoy this episode. So now stay tuned for some announcements of upcoming events. These are upcoming events for January and February 2020. This is the time of pharma conferences. It's early winter, and these will go on to probably about early spring when farmers have time to attend these things. And I'll say to you farmers and ranchers out there, other than financial reasons or family reasons, there's no reason why you should not be attending these conferences. If you do not have slack in your schedule to attend these conferences and to gain knowledge and education about your given profession, then you're doing something wrong. I remember talking to a person online and was talking about some of the conferences that were coming up. And this person said, I don't have time to go to that. I'm too busy on the farm. And my response to this person was, if you don't have time to go educate yourself and to gain knowledge that will make you a better farmer or a better rancher, then you're doing something wrong. You are doing something wrong. Now, I understand the issue about cost. I understand that not everybody has $300 or $400 to drop down on a conference registration, and on top of that, pay travel costs, including mileage and hotel. I understand that. But a lot of these conferences have scholarships for farmers and ranchers, and you need to take it upon yourself to find out what these are, what knowledge you can gain from it, and if it's going to be beneficial to you, you need to attend. Now, having said that, here are some upcoming conferences. The Southern Sustainable Agriculture Working Group, or as most of us know it, Southern SAW, will be having their annual conference January 22nd through 25th in Little Rock at the Little Rock Convention Center. The theme of the conference is agricultural resistance in a changing climate. This is a really good conference, y'all. This is our regional, for those of you in the Southeast, this is our regional sustainable ag conference. The Winston County Self-Help Cooperative is having the final conference of a series of conferences they have throughout the state of Mississippi on February 1st at Rust College in Holly Springs, Mississippi. Frank Taylor does a lot of really good work around saving rural communities with a particular emphasis on Black farmers and the efforts that, and the challenges that Black farmers go, but really focus on rural America in general. So if you can make this, please do. Frank does a series of conferences starting in the last week of January and taking on all out to the end of February. So you can get more information at the Winston County Self-Help Cooperative. Just Google that on Facebook. And for Southern SAWG, just Google Southern SAWG. That's SSAWG. And you'll get information about that conference. And then the Georgia Organics Conference, which is our state sustainable ag and organic organization in Georgia, is having their annual conference February 7th through the 8th at the Classic Center in Athens, Georgia. This is an excellent conference for those of you in Georgia and surrounding areas. So some of you who are in lower South Carolina, close to the Georgia border, this would be a good conference for you to come to. They may have some scholarships available, but go ahead and attend it. This year, Southern SAWG has sponsored a Black Farmer Prosperity Track, which is all about how Black farmers can become prosperous. You know, once again, going back to the three-legged stool, the financial leg is very, very important, and all farmers need to be financially viable, but it's especially important for Black farmers who are, as a large part of the farming community as a whole, our population is diminishing. So we need to make sure that those folks who, the Black people who decide to make this a vocation and a profession and a career, that they are sustainable and that they can make a living wage and that they can support their families and that type of stuff. And that's what the track at Georgia Organics is going to be about. So those are your upcoming events. If you have upcoming events, you hit me up at info@sustainableagrider.com and try and give me at least a month's notice so I can make sure that I can promote your event or your conference or your field day with adequate notice so people have plenty of time to be able to attend these things. Peace out. So welcome back to the Sustainable Ag Writer Podcast. I'm here with Keisha Cameron of High Hog Farm. How are you, Keisha?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
You've been traveling a lot.
I have. I just got back from an agroecology tour with in Cuba with NAP. So that was an amazing experience.
Uh-huh. So, that was a quick trip, wasn't it? How long were you down there?
I was only gone for about a week. There for about a week and got to see a number of different small farms and cooperatives there. It was truly inspiring.
Good. Yeah. Good. Warren, go with you, or you went solo?
No. You know how I roll. Somebody's got to watch the farm, so.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, I want to have you on, Keisha, to talk about, I know you have a passion for fiber, and I think you're the only African-American farmer that I know that grows, that raises animals specifically for fiber. I'm sure there's more out there. But I like to talk about how you got your interest in fiber, what you're doing now, and then we can have a conversation about it. Because I also want to talk about this whole hemp craze that's hitting the country. But let's talk about your farm, High Hog Farm. When did you start it? What do you grow?
Well, we have officially been farmers, you know, on the books, as it were, for about almost 6 years. We're going into year six this April. But we've been on this piece of property on the land for almost 10 years now. We started off with a gift of 7 baby chicks from my horseback riding instructor, and 5 of those turned out to be roosters. And that was very, very early on in the process, before we were really diving into learning land management and just how to be sustainable stewards of agricultural stewards. Mm-hmm. Fast forward now, we have sheep. I've discovered a passion for sheep that does not necessarily, I don't know that I can explain why I just seem to get them. Mm-hmm. That's my thing. We have had small ruminants for about six, 7 years anyway with goats. Mm-hmm. And I have my horse, and we also raise rabbits and chickens. Okay. So yeah, we have.
You still have your goats?
I do. We have 4 goats. So just, yeah. Why are you looking for some goats?
No. I don't have enough room, and I hear they're master escape artists. So.
They are. Mm-hmm. A little bit about, we do things a little differently because we didn't intend on becoming production farmers when we mm-hmm. first started. It was kind of the homestead journey.
Right.
And the goats are my sons. So mm-hmm. I foresee within the next 3 to 4 years when he's gone and, you know, in college or out of the house, we probably will scale back and not eliminate the goats. Mm-hmm. But for now, they're here and they provide enough comedy for for all of us.
Yes, yes. Good stress relief. So tell me about your work with your sheep. Now, I've seen you on Facebook. You're starting to spin some of your wool now. And...
I am. Uh-huh. I am. This was our first year. We got a starter flock 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So we bought all lambs that year. Mm-hmm. And last spring had our first shearing. So I had our fleeces. And there's a program through the Livestock Conservancy, which works to preserve heritage breeds and endangered breeds, specifically domestic breeds to the United States. And we raise Gulf Coast natives, which are on that conservancy list. So we got 4 of those fleeces that we sheared and then sold raw wool. I hadn't begun really spinning and well enough for me to be comfortable with selling at that point. So we sold the wool as raw wool through the Save 'em to Shave 'em program, which the Livestock Conservancy puts together. And that was huge because it was one of those things where we're a family farm, and Warren, my husband, has been very, you talk to him, he's been very adamant about things being able to pay for themselves. So mm-hmm. that was one of the first times right out of the chute that we were able to make a profit because we were able to sell to hand spinners. So mm-hmm. it got his interest very early on, which was huge for me. So, mm-hmm.
so is there a good market for wool? And
there is. There's actually, so it falls under, if I'm not mistaken, kind of the craft market. Okay. So hand spinners mm-hmm. is a, I don't know the exact number. I know it's a couple $1 billion that mm-hmm. people will spend on raw wool mm-hmm. and other forms of fiber for handmade textiles. So it's not the same as you would think in the commercial big ag, big industry, textile industry, but there's definitely a niche there and there's money to be made there if you can figure out how to right size it. Mm. And it's a bit of a balancing act. So we're learning as we go.
Okay. What's your goals eventually with your flock? What's the end result?
Besides how many sheep can I support? I would like to eventually be able to sell value-added products. So from anything from the raw wool is great, but I would like to be able to process that wool into roving or top that could be sold, as well as finished yarn. I don't know whether or not I want to move into actual apparel or finished goods.
Right.
I like the idea of doing that. And we have actually talked about augmenting some of that with our, because, you know, before this, we had the herbs and vegetables.
Right.
So expanding and shifting to some of the dye plants so mm-hmm. that we can have some naturally dyed wools and yarns to sell to people as well.
What are some of the... natural dyes. I know about indigo, but what else?
Yeah, that's one of the plants. So there's a Japanese indigo as well as a Caribbean indigo, and I'm sourcing seed for that. Mm-hmm. There is a farm that I believe that's in Tennessee that has done some work and put some information out about how to grow that. Does very well here in this climate.
Yeah.
It's also in the legume family, so it's a nitrogen fixing mm-hmm. plant, which mm-hmm. works great for soil health. Mm-hmm. But we're also looking at plants like madder root, marigolds. There's a whole slew of natural flowers and other natural plants that are in our environment. And everybody locally has something that grows that can be used as a dye stuff. Okay. So I've just started doing that. I was able to do a couple workshops and then experimented a bit on my own.
Okay.
It was exciting.
I actually, Southern Sierra actually funded that Indigo project.
Really?
Tennessee. So we had a summer meeting there maybe 2 years ago and we got to visit it.
So you're the expert that's going to come help this spring. Help
well,
me plant.
I can point you to the expert that can come help you. but it was really unique and she really seemed to be carving out some interesting niches. I could think a lot of high-end gene companies were contacting her.
Yep. Yeah, there's a demand for local textile products. Yeah. I'm noticing more fiber wool yarn shops like that popping up locally because mm-hmm. people are looking, just like the move to eat local, there's a move for local fiber sources and supply. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, there's not a cohesive network. There's a few mills nearby and there's mm-hmm. people who can process, but there are certain gaps that need to be filled within that, within right. the industry. So really collaborating and working with people, or just getting to know your farmer who has that and working with them on how you can, if you are a fiber artist, mm-hmm. trying to find that local source is definitely opportunities out there.
Right. When you were talking about your sheep, what type of carrying capacity does sheep has as far as being on the land? For example, how many per acre or?
Well, okay. So your stocking rate really mm-hmm. is affected by the health of your pasture. And we okay. have marginal pastures mm-hmm. right now. So my stocking rate is about 7 per acre.
Okay.
I've heard estimates anywhere from 9 to 11. And that's if you're treating your pasture as your sole crop or mm-hmm. your sole means of feed annually. We supplement with hay. Okay. Right now we have 4 sheep. We have a wether who carries a color genetic. So he's like a black sheep. He's got kind of a brown, rusty wool. Mm-hmm. And then the other two the other 3 are my ewes who are bred right now. So we expect to have, well, at least 3 more lambs come January. Mm-hmm. So we'll be up to about 6. And one of the things that's really important that I emphasize, and because it's been emphasized to me, is through my mentor, Jan Southers. She's the farmer in Daniels, Colbert, actually, Georgia, who raises these and is a breeder, is being very selective about your breeding stock because it's an endangered or threatened gotcha. Animal. You want to keep the best quality. So they are considered a dual purpose sheep. Most of the African American fibers farmers that I know that do have sheep usually use them for meat. And then the wool is kind of an added benefit that people might.
Gotcha.
If they know a market or somebody asks them specifically, they might sell it. I'm the other way around, but I keep in the back of my mind that once we have these animals hit the land, that my carrying capacity is finite. Mm-hmm. That what I can do to support them so that I'm not degrading the land further, but they're actually adding to mm-hmm. the sustainability of the property, and that I'm trying to improve the breed, we will then pass them on either to somebody else, especially because I don't keep a ram. The only breeding, I don't keep a ram or a buck. Mm-hmm. The only breeding that I do on farm, only breeding that I do is with my rabbits. So okay. I dud my goats and my sheep out in every end of every summer.
What's the difference between a ram and a buck?
Containment? No. the ram is the male, intact male sheep, and the mm-hmm. buck is intact male goat.
Okay.
And so when breeding season comes around, mm-hmm. that, and you hear stories, but they can become more difficult to handle. And since I'm such a new farmer, or mm-hmm. new hand shepherd, mm-hmm. I'm taking things step by step and really developing. So the first year was just learning basic sheep care and maintenance, animal husbandry. The next year was then the shearing. Then from there, now we're entering into breeding and lambing. And once I can get a handle and know what to look for mm-hmm. when I'm with those animals, then I might consider adding a ram.
Gotcha.
Keeping a ram. But you have to have them separate, or mm-hmm. if you run them together, you might be having lambs throughout the season without
right,
affecting
right.
them. So,
Now, you said these are called Gulf Coast sheep?
Yes, they're Gulf Coast or Gulf Coast natives.
Okay.
Are the names that they go by.
Okay. So that being that they're Gulf Coast natives, are they like sheep like goats and they have a propensity to get really bothered by parasites?
That's a great question because this particular breed is what people would term a landrace breed. It is not one of the refined breeds like Merino, for example, but it has a lot of genetic diversity. They had actually at one point gone feral throughout their history or semi-feral. Mm-hmm. Their numbers dwindled, and those that survived developed a certain characteristics and resiliency so that they're not parasite-proof, but they're highly parasite-resistant.
Okay.
So that is something that bodes very well for sheep in the Southeast.
Mm-hmm.
I think sheep can handle a moist climate and they can handle a hot climate, but the Southeast has both.
Mm-hmm.
And that means parasites and parasite buildup can become really difficult, but they do well at handling that load. So far, we famacha check their eyes, eyelids. Every now and then we'll do a stool sample. We use natural herbs. We supplement with natural herbs and minerals. We'll use sea kelp or wormwood periodically with their feed and make sure they have access to a diverse range of browse in addition to the hay and feed that we give them. But all of those things together can help regulate and keep their parasite load in check. So far, it's not foolproof, but our management practices so far has been really good. So we haven't had to use chemical wormers
to
worm them. That is an option because, you know, their health and welfare comes first. So if we ever get to that point, we would do that. But so far, we have been really fortunate not to have had a heavy load.
Okay. Now, there's, since you have mentioned wormers, so a lot of folks who, and specifically around meat, are sometimes reluctant to eat meat that has been consistently wormed with commercial wormers.
Yeah.
Is that an issue for fiber, though? Because you're not really eating it. Are there any other?
No, I haven't. Well, not that I've heard of. I've never come across that. I know there are a lot of people who have sensitivities to wool. Wool may irritate their skin, and that's usually because it's the wrong type of wool in that particular application. It may not be something that the lanolin or something that is an irritant, but I've never heard anything as far as the parasite or any type of chemical or antibiotic use that's affected anybody and transferred to anybody because it's not something you ingest.
Okay. Are you looking at any other types of animals for fiber? When you're going
to start going out
packing?
Of course I am. So I have another shepherd that I really, really like, Beth Warner. She actually is the director, I hope I got her title right, of the Georgia Wool and Sheep Association. And she raises Tunis sheep, which are also a dual purpose breed, also on the Livestock Conservancy list as a heritage breed. I've been looking at them. I don't know that I like their wool quality as much as the Gulf Coast, but I did have the opportunity to sample some of the wool from her flock, and it is nice. It definitely has a specific qualities. The application for it, that would be really nice. And then the third breed that I'm looking at is also another. I lean towards heritage breeds, is the Jacob. They're a bit more primitive, cheap, and I have been told by other shepherds that have been around them that they take a little bit more. They're not a beginner sheep.
Gotcha.
They need a little bit more seasoned or skilled hand. So that is on my horizon because they have a really, really nice fleece, like a really nice wool. So wool quality. And then lastly, outside of sheep, this is how we kind of started. We had Angora rabbit. So I have been spinning Angora rabbit fluff. We call it wool, but it's not technically the same as a wool. I've been spinning that. So it would be nice to have as far as protein-based fibers from the sheep and the rabbit. Those are the ones that I'm thinking about for use for blending. And then there's a whole range of plant-based fibers that I'm considering integrating into a silvopasture system like the indigo, but also spinning cotton, flax, nettles. So we're doing a little research right now in the off season about what we want to plant and what we're want to experiment with in the next year or two.
So you're going to try and do it organically, the cotton?
I would like to. What I came across, because I called Department of Ag, the State Department of Ag, and asked some questions, and I was pointed to a resource about the cotton, the permit. You need a permit or a license to grow cotton and ornamental cotton in a home garden.
Oh, really?
That's how it's classified or broken down, separate from, like, you have to be a certain distance from commercial growers, et cetera, et cetera, because of the boll weevil in the epidemic that almost wiped out a vast majority of the cotton industry. So now what they want, if I'm reading their information correctly, they want a certain use of pesticides and herbicides that are used within that growing space. Mm-hmm. And there's parameters on that. I have a call back into the gentleman to talk with him because I want to ask some questions specifically about that before we commit. We had to spot treat last year for the first time in 8 years. We had to spot treat for with the help of a Philip Brown out of NRCS out of up near Athens. He's a pasture grassland specialist, and he and my NRCS local NRCS guy came out and he's helped me over the past year because we're trying to improve our pastures. And we had three different particular noxious weeds that were not responsive. So we did have to spot treat about an acre and a half where I literally walked and just tried to eliminate those particular ones. And that was heartbreaking. I had hoped that by some miracle, I had some special touch that I could eliminate these weeds on my own. And that it's wasn't the case. It doesn't work like that. It gave me a different perspective though. There's so much criticism about farmers that use these harmful chemicals and I've never liked it, but I understand, you know, I'm doing this with my family. I don't have whole sections of our population that are dependent upon being provided food. And it made me step down off my high horse just a little bit and appreciate the challenges that they face. I still really very firm and selective about what we use. And then we've fortunately, we only have the four goats and the four sheep. So we've been able to keep them off that area and none of them are in milk or in production. So there's no consumption, but still there is an impact. But if I want to be able to sustain their health, then that was the choice. That was the trade-off. And if I hadn't been stubborn as I was, I knew that this was going to be a thing about a year and a half ago. And then last year, it was spiny amaranth and horse nettle. And the horse nettle has the spikes up top and bottom, and it spreads through the root and the flower. So that thing was like, oh, well, if you're not going to check me, we're just going to spread.
That's the one that has that big purple head, right?
It's got the white and purple flower that can come up. It's not a thistle, but it has this, I don't know how to describe it. It has a spikes on the stem, the top of the leaf and the bottom of the leaf. And most of the animals, even with the spiny amaranth, which you'd call pigweed, has that kind of pink stem. They'll nibble the leaves, but it's like pruning the plant and then the plant just sends out another shoot. So those two, I eventually just had to, I had to treat, but I got off track. You'd asked me something and I went down this road about herbicides, but the cotton, I don't know if I'm going to need, I don't know for sure if I'm going to have to use something, but I would prefer not to. So
hopefully they have approved some natural treatments.
There are a few different organically approved, definitely herbicides. We're trying this thing with the rabbits, with American chinchilla rabbits, and tractoring them on pasture because they eat a broader variety. I've noticed they eat a wider diversity of forage and browse than my goats do. My goats are spoiled, so they're picky. Whereas when I move the rabbits in concentrated areas across the pasture, they actually are eating, and I'm able to come back behind and seed, much like people use broiler chickens.
Gotcha.
But the benefit is that rabbit manure is what I refer to as a green manure. It's it doesn't, it's not hot. It can go directly on, and it's higher in nitrogen, which is helping. So I'll let you know whether or not that ends up working for us.
Okay.
That if we can see results faster that way.
Okay. Well, I was at a meeting a couple of weeks ago in Virginia, and the director of the American Agroforestry Association was there. And we were having lunch, and we were just mentioning some of the issues we have with trying to get people to adopt silvopasture practices on their land. And for those of our listeners who don't know what that is, that's basically running animals in between your planting of trees or that type of stuff. The most common one that people know about is running cattle through stands of pine trees. But anyway, we, you know, I was telling her that eventually on my place, I want to do some alley cropping and maybe run some chickens in between my fruit trees when I get them all pulled in. But you sounded like you had some interesting ideas about what you envision a silvopasture operation looking like at your place.
I have had this idea since I actually, since the very first year when we became farmers. So it's been a minute, because I ran into some farmers who were down in South Georgia who do exactly that with pine. And I don't know if they use cattle or hogs, but they, it's, you know, the perennial rotation and it's established stands. So what I had wanted to do was kind of a modified food forest. So the fruit trees and the different layers. So I, my little bit of study with permaculture and agroecology, but using the canopy layer with your fruit and nut trees, and then working down. So you have your shrub layer and your lower layer, but instead of just having them be edibles, working in things like indigo or madder root, or trying to think other fiber-based plants, so the cotton, and have them fill those voids within those beds and do them on contour or with a, within swales and raised beds, and then rotating and moving your animals through those aisles. Yeah, so it's, we started trying to do these with 8x8 plots with the tree in the center, and then we fenced it. And we fenced T-posts and used goat wire because, you know, that's, goat is in the name for the wire. But the goats very quickly managed to eat and tear the bark off at least six of the 20 trees that we had planted down there. We lost, for sure, we've lost three of them. So now we're playing around with whether or not we can hot wire around them. So this, how the setup will work, and what we can, how much pressure we can allow to be within that space, because we'd had deer pressure in the past, but the goats did the worst bit of damage. So we're reworking how we're going to do that for the spring and what we're going to plant in there. And right now, we're, I think we're going to just focus on rabbits and chickens.
Okay.
Because even the damage would, if they were to be able to encroach upon that planting area, those planting zones, they wouldn't, it wouldn't be catastrophic loss because, you know, we're, and they just set us at least two and a half years back.
So basically, once you run your chickens and your rabbits through the area, then you're going back with pasture seed. Is that the idea?
Yes. So rotating them in zones, and it's generally integrated rotational grazing that still applies, but throughout the space. And then there's different seasons that I'm really leaning towards. So if we can get a proper barrier established, we would actually lead with the largest animal first, which would be the small ruminants, the goats and the sheep. And then we would come behind with the rabbits and then the chickens would clean up. And then there, that area would be sectioned off. And then we come behind with a mixture of pasture mix. And we're doing an annual and perennial mix because we're trying to have a variety, a good diversity of products, so that seasonally, right now we seed pasture three times a year, and that's fairly intense. It would be nice if we didn't have to do it quite as frequently. So
what grasses are you using?
Right now we're using Red River crabgrass and Cerisa lespediza as the two main types of forage. The Cerisa lespediza is also noted for its parasite, helps mm-hmm. with parasite resistance. So that's really, really good. And then I add things like, right now we just added rye. Perennial rye doesn't survive. So it's an annual rye. Red clover, Dutch white clover. I'm looking right at it. Brown top millet in the summer. There's a few others. I'm sure I'm vetch. Rape. There's a few others that we mix in.
Okay.
And I've even found that for the goats and the sheep, that every now and then, if I can get some mustards or like a turnip or something like mm-hmm. that to come up in there, it helps break up that compaction mm-hmm. a little bit. The root crops do, and they like the tops. So
okay. You don't have a Bermuda grass at your place?
I do have a little bit of Bermuda in immediately around the house in the back, and we have been fortunate enough so far that our driveway mm-hmm. and our breaks that up. Mm-hmm. And then I planted herbs around. So I have chives and yarrow that are planted right around the border between where they meet. And because mm-hmm. they also spread, and lemon balm and mint, mm-hmm. they have been so far. See, you say this, and then next season I'm going to have something. But yeah, so far.
Yeah, I don't want to jinx you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, I wish I could give you this Bermuda I have over here. So.
No, thank you. No, thank you. And actually, the crabgrass is more nutritious for mm-hmm. Bermuda. I think the reason Bermuda is so popular in horse pastures is because it holds up under pressure. Mm-hmm. It's hard to get rid of. So yeah. even the toughest horse mm-hmm. can't ever really get rid of it. So, yeah.
We've got a funded for a pollinator to install Ooh. Some pollinator gardens here through NRCS. And so a lot of it we were going to put at the front. And I was talking with Ryan, who's our NRCS guy, about how am I going to get rid of this Bermuda grass? Because when it's time to seed the stuff, the flowers won't be able to outcompete the Bermuda. So, you know, yeah. one of the suggestions he gave me was just to get some Roundup heavy duty and just burn it all off, which I don't know if I want to do that.
Understood.
Yeah.
Have you tried? So... We just put down a silage tarp in the goat pasture, the mm-hmm. area where we have moved in the animals up to the front pasture. Mm-hmm. And we put down a silage tarp, which is about 50 by 100.
Okay.
And we're trying to smother mm-hmm. the weeds because I didn't want a spot treat in that area.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
that might be an option. I don't know.
Have you picked it up yet?
I have not. My okay. intention is not to do it until it's That's time true. To seed in the spring.
Okay. We didn't use an actual silage tarp, but we got some really, really heavy-duty tarps, okay. black. Mm-hmm. And we had a problematic area down in the back that where we grew onions. We just didn't do well with our onions because of the Bermuda. And the nut sedge was horrible down there, too. So we've had it covered since about August. So hopefully, you know, we're not going to take it off till the spring.
Okay. And, yeah, you haven't killed it
we'll
back
see
yet.
See how it is. But we were able to get a lot of it down before it got really hot in the summer. You know,
and
with a small farmer, sometimes giving up that production area is kind of tough sometimes. So.
Yes. Yes, it is.
So
what are you going to plant back in? I'm just curious what you're going to fill the space, what to outcompete, what's left.
We may do tomatoes in that area next year.
Your vegetables.
The veggies we really had a problem with were like our onions and stuff. They just couldn't spread. So. We're either going to just plant them into landscape cloth next year, or we're going to just do a tall of a vegetable. So, yeah. Well, I'll be interested to see how it works out. So, you been doing any speaking lately?
No, okay. It's been nice. I haven't had no homework on my part. So okay. It's been nice to be off for a little while.
Okay. Are you going to any conferences this year? Any of the big conferences?
Honestly, I thought about Southern SOG and mm-hmm. I thought about Georgia Organics, but the past 2 years has been every month or at least every other month I've been traveling. So mm-hmm. I'm wanting to just nest a little bit at home and get my hands back in the dirt yep. consistently. So I don't think I'm going anywhere unless mm-hmm. it's just too good to be true. Cuba was too good to be true. You don't pass that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's once in a lifetime.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cuba reminds me a lot of what I saw in Puerto Rico, just the small farms. And I'm looking forward to my next trip there. And what else you been doing? The boys are growing up.
My boys are huge. I referred to my oldest as a teenager, and he paused and reminded me that he's 22. And I had to, I just had to shake my head. I'm not ready for them to be, well, I'm not ready for them to be grown, and I'm not quite ready for them to be gone because they're my help here on the phone.
Right.
So I don't know what I'm going to do when I don't have the extra hands.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. So do you know any other farmers, specifically Black farmers, who are doing fiber?
A handful. Mm-hmm. I actually just put an inquiry out on a national Black ag group and asked this specifically this question just last week. Mm-hmm. And I've only gotten maybe 10 or 15 responses. Mm-hmm. Most of the farmers that I know that I'm familiar with raise the sheep for, or hair sheep for meat. I don't know any that do dairy, but there is a lady by the name of Deborah Green who raises Shetlands up in Kentucky. And I came across her about 2 or 3 years ago, through a mutual friend. And she has been very encouraging. She helped me as I was trying to decide which breed we wanted to pursue initially. Mm-hmm. And then she responded to the question that I posed or the comment that I made within that post that I put up there last week. Mm-hmm. About collaborating ideas around potential markets and what would it look like to have a local fiber shed? Because our fiber network in this country, for as far as I'm aware, for small farmers, I don't know how big ag, you know that there's a huge textile industry.
Yes,
you know, it employs 500,000 people. And I think I read something that said that each employee for every job within the textile industry, it supports 3 other jobs, the creation of 3 other jobs within this in the country. So there's clearly cotton, hemp, as you mentioned it, those are big industries. But as far as the small farmer and particularly with Black farmers that occupy that space, I'm not familiar with that many. I met a woman on, of course, Tanya Toya, her name is going to miss me. I'm going to forget the name for a moment, but she has a mill in Ohio, is a Black owned mill. She and her husband operate. And I think she can do something like a ton or 2 tons of wool within her space to process at a time. Deborah, the sheep farmer. And then there's a few others that are out there. But as far as the network's concerned, I'm not very familiar. I would like to learn from some others because I just have to believe that there was a time when this was part of our heritage and our history, good, bad, or ugly, but whichever way you look at it, this was still knowledge that was held, cultural knowledge and cultural assets that were ours. Just like we understand that there was trauma around cotton and cotton production, it was because we were also skilled and knowledged in that labor, and that labor was exploited. But I had done some reading around some of trying to find, you know, who are those names? Who are those historical figures? Who are those African-Americans who have done this work and carried this and this knowledge around sheep and wool, be it South or the North or what have you? And the only thing I kept coming back to were the slave narratives, which I found in the Library of Congress. And there were many references about having to shear the sheep or finding the leftovers of what was sheared and being able to make your own clothes and what was provided, the provisions that were allotted. So it wasn't uncommon, or it was knowledge that we had, but I haven't really done enough study to find those elders that still have that can share some of those narratives and educate me around that. I know people who quilt, definitely know some Julius Tillery, who was up in
North Carolina,
Black cotton. But to find people who specifically focused on wool, I have not so far outside of the voices and the stories of those who were enslaved. Wow. And that's a little heartbreaking because, you know, you talk to people individually and they say, oh, my grandma knit, or my my aunt taught me to crochet, or I used, you know, I know my cousin used to spin, but you don't hear that in connection to where those textiles came from.
Yeah. Yeah.
If that makes sense. I would love,
yes,
if there's anybody that listens, is, you know, tunes into your podcast and has some of that knowledge to share, I would love to hear more.
Okay.
Those stories are important to me.
That's one of the reasons why I'm doing this, to make sure we connect with folks. And, you know, I'm really interested in a lot of work that Ira Wallace is doing with Southern Seed, Southern Exposure Seed Company, because like you said, even as these crops became commercialized, and let's say our folks didn't grow them anymore, they just passed them down. The other thing we're losing, though, is the history. So Ira's very honest when she did. I don't know if you've ever seen one of her presentations, her full presentation.
Yeah.
She comes right out and says, you know, I know these seeds were certain seeds that she talks about in these talks that she gave. She said, I know they were developed and kept by African Americans, but we don't have pictures. We don't know. At some point, it got passed up to a white farmer, but it was actually a black farmer who may have developed the seed. But then we lost that history. We lost that train. We have to start to try and capture that. So,
yeah. What I also love about Mama Ira is she also was a crafter.
Yeah.
When she first started, she did textile crafts and other crafts, as well as seed saving. And the seed saving, as she told me, became so prevalent. That's where her attention, her focus was. Yeah. But it was really nice because she kind of got me in the sense, you know, she understood where this desire to reconnect with that Black agrarian arts.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Have you been to her farm?
I haven't.
Oh,
yeah.
It's a really
unique
place. If you ever have a chance to go up there,
yeah.
It's a really unique. I'm going to try and go during the summer. When I went up, it was off season.
Okay.
I wanted to talk to her about, I just wanted to go visit. So I was in Virginia. But I would really love to go up there in the summer when she really has everything blooming and stuff like that to see it. And the seed operation is amazing. So
I think she has 6 different cotton varieties.
Oh, really?
And 4 of them of different colors. She has a green, a brown, a white, and a red listed.
Oh, wow.
So I've considered those because cotton isn't all just white. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Okay. Okay. Well, Keisha, I want to thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for having me. This has been fun.
And I'll let you know, the first show is going to be broadcast January 8th, but I'm just trying to stack up in.
Okay.
So I have enough episodes to make sure that people have enough content to keep them coming. And I'll come over and visit. People on the podcast don't know this, but we're neighbors. So.
Yeah.
I haven't been over to your place in a while, actually. So.
Yeah. Look, bring your boots.
Oh,
gloves.
Okay.
I really appreciate you doing this, Brandon. It's great seeing it come to fruition.
We need
your voice.
We are going to have a high tunnel raising party over here pretty soon. So.
Okay. Well, let me know.
Yep. We'll do some barbecue and just get her up.
All right. And hug Gwen for me.
I sure will. She's driving now. So.
Yeah. Oh, look out.
she's back to driving. So, all right, Keisha, thanks again.
All right.
And I'd like to have you on again to talk about some of your progress as you get further into stuff. So.
All right. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care.
Everybody said hi.
Will do. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainable Ag Writer podcast. Please visit our website at sustainableagwriter.com, where you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. If you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Please tell your friends and colleagues about the show and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Once again, thank you for listening to the Sustainable Ag Writer podcast, sustainable ag news and views.